Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Come on, show me the magic.
Can I take you out to the pictures?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movies.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome to the Beatles Films Podcast. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
We're both professional film writers and Fab Four fans, and each week we discuss a different movie about, starring, or inspired by the Beatles. But we're changing things up slightly this time around because we're reaching the end of our first season. So to end season one of the Beatles Films Podcast on a bang, we wanted to cover an actual, proper, bona fide Beatles film. And that film is Help! Exclamation mark. The Beatles' second studio movie, released to tie in with their fifth studio album, and marking the first time a pop group appeared in a story about a religious cult performing a sacrificial murder. What we thought we'd do to give this film full attention it deserves is split this episode out in two halves. So for the first part, we've got a broad view that will cover mostly the actual music in the film. So the songs, the tunes, the score. And then in part two next week, we'll focus on the story. That's right. We've decided to split this Beatles films episode into Beatles and film. We're not entirely convinced by the approach, but you know, let's see how we get on. So just talking about the music then in the film Help. It seems to me that where we have very separate song segments in the film, you have to wonder whether or not this is the first time we have ever seen anything close to what eventually becomes a music video. What do you think?
It does seem that way, doesn't it? It's really difficult to know. You hear different people say different things about what was the first music video. So Paperback Writer and Rain that they shot down at Chiswick House seems to be something that people bring up a lot. And a lot of people say it's Bohemian Rhapsody. I don't know what distinction people are making between those two things because there's quite a few years between them.
It's down to purpose though, right? So we know that Paperback Writer and Rain... those videos were filmed to substitute an actual appearance by the Beatles on the show. What show was it?
Top of the Pops.
It was,
I guess.
Top of the Pops, right? Yeah. I thought it was Top of the Pops. Okay, fine. So we know that they shot those music videos specifically to be used because the Beatles weren't able to appear on their show.
Yeah.
When it comes to Bohemian Rhapsody, the purpose of that maybe was just to have a tie-in video to go alongside the song, so there's a different sort of, you know, it has an entertainment value rather than just rather than a functional value.
That is probably the distinction people are making.
I mean, I am speculating entirely, but I assume that that's, you know, that seems to make sense to me. But then I think the interesting thing then is what we see in Help seems to be a bit of a precursor to what we get with Paperback Writer and Rain, in that the song segments themselves don't fit in with the rest of the narrative of the movie. Normally, they are the story stops in order to allow for a song segment to occur.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing this is different into compared to how, you know, songs like these have been used in other musical films before now.
Yeah. So in Help, there are some songs that it makes narrative sense for them to perform, others that it makes less narrative sense, and others where they aren't actually performing, they're kind of clowning around with the song as a background.
Yes, that's true, yeah.
So You're Gonna Lose That Girl and The Night Before and I Need You are all the Beatles, the characters, the Beatles in the film, are recording those songs in a studio. Two yes. of them are a studio that is outdoors on Salisbury Plain, but even so,
yeah.
there is a narrative reason for them to be recording those songs. And there are others where, so A Ticket to Ride, for example, that is the sort of purest sort of music video approach to the song, to any of the songs, really, where you're hearing the song and you're seeing footage of them skiing. There is a tiny bit where there is a piano on this mountain and they're just sort of mucking about on it and John is kind of singing along into the camera.
Yeah.
That's the only bit. But at that point, it's not being pretended that this band is actually standing there performing these songs.
No, yeah, sure. Know? Yeah, yeah. I think maybe it would be worth us talking about sort of music generally, and maybe we should go through each of these songs in turn, because I think there's quite a bit to say about each of them,
sure.
So we can do them in sort of chronological order.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I did want to say, though, was I think it's quite clever and quite forward-thinking, I think, that the film makes sure that each of the song segments has a very distinct look and feel, separate from each other.
Yeah.
Like they feel like they can be taken out of context and work. And actually, because of how iconic the Beatles were at this time, and because therefore how iconic this film is, the actual video performances in the film sort of have taken on a bit of a life of their own outside of the context of the movie. You know, I feel like You've Got to Hide Your Love Away, for example, in particular, I feel like I've seen that more times than I've seen the film. That feels like it exists on its own as a as a, you know, de facto music video for the song. But yeah, quite intuitive in some ways that the actual footage that's used for each of those songs just feels very distinctly different from each other, but also has a I guess what has become quite an iconic look for each of them.
Yeah, and I think there's a sort of visual association I have. So you've got to Hide Your Love Away is sort of best example of that. And perhaps it's because it's one of those songs that there isn't any narrative reason for them to perform in the film. When I think of that song, that's the mental image I have. I think of John singing it, sitting in that chair and playing that guitar. And yeah, I think maybe the fact that they are, I mean, we should kind of set it in context that what is happening with You've Got to Hide Your Love Away is they're on the run from various people who are trying to find and kill them. And the best place they found to hide is their house.
Where no one would find them.
Exactly. It's the last place they think to look. And they go back there with Arme, played by Eleanor Bron. And while there, they perform You've Got to Hide Your Love Away. So there are bits in it where you kind of think that there is a bit of narrative being extended here. There's a bit where Paul is kind of winking at Arme. George is sort of playing his guitar sort of increasing closer to her.
At her.
He's playing his guitar.
It's quite like,
at her, you're right.
It's very aggressive, like aggressive move on his part, sit on the same sofa.
Yeah, and you're kind of seeing, especially because of George's facial expressions, which is sort of done really well in close-up, and there is quite a lot of good close-up acting by the Beatles in this film in general, that he is sort of looking at her and looking at Paul and getting a bit annoyed and jealous. That storyline is not ever extended or thought of again. And actually, even what you think is going to happen, i.e. that Paul and Arme are going to get together, that never happens either, you know?
No, it's a good point, actually.
It's so it does, you know, it's sort of extending a narrative thread, but then just kind of snapping it at the end, really, and not doing anything with it.
Why don't we, you know, let's park You've Got to Hide Your Love Away until we get to that, because I feel like there's a potentially a reason to go through it in chronological order, because I feel like there's a, without going into the narrative of the actual film, there's sort of a narrative flow that the songs give just on their own.
Yeah.
But one of the things I did want to touch on as well, talking about sort of the different or distinct look and feel that each song has, is it's actually quite interesting to me that Ticket to Ride, that whole skiing segment, has become the overall sort of iconography of the Help album and film.
Yeah.
You know, like them in the snow. That's sort of the poster of this sort of, you know, creative venture.
Yeah.
But it's not really necessarily as more or less important than any other songs in the film. It's not given necessarily due prominence more than anything else. And it's not even the song, you'd be forgiven for thinking that the skiing montage is the point at which they play Help.
That would make sense. I suppose maybe it's the, I think the film was kind of put together before the album artwork, because obviously that's the album artwork is them in there. They're not in the snow, but they are against a white background, yeah, wearing their skiing gear, which of course includes a top hat for George. I mean, who doesn't take a top hat when they go skiing, you know? And doing the semaphore, which originally was going to spell out H-E-L-P. They did that and it looked a bit crap, so they just changed it. They're doing, I forget what it spells out.
I think it's N-U-F-T, I think, or N-U-J-T or something like that.
Right, yeah. Okay.
Okay, so shall we start from the beginning? So right at the start of the film, we have, quite obviously, the song Help.
Yeah.
To introduce the film Help.
Yeah.
Clever.
It is clever. Yeah. But also, it's really clever.
Yeah.
Is another point I'd like to make about this. Because I think, you know, you have this setup in the film where the cult have discovered that the ring is missing. And the question is, where is the ring? And it immediately cuts to the ring on Ringo's hand.
Yep.
As he drums to the song Help. But what I really love about this whole sequence is that it's then plays out during the opening credits on a projector screen in black and white.
Yeah.
And then you have these darts being thrown at the screen, which are in colour.
Yeah.
And I hadn't really thought about it until I watched the film specifically for this podcast, but I just couldn't help but think, like, how amazing would that look if you were seeing that in the cinema? Like, the projector screen, the close-up of the projector screen then doubles as the cinema screen. You're seeing the Beatles in black and white,
yeah,
as you will have done throughout most of their career, if not all of their career, to that point.
Yeah.
And then you just have these really vibrant shots of colour and these darts, like, you know, piercing the image,
yeah,
to really sort of usher in this idea that this is the Beatles in colour for the first time.
Yeah, and like, and what a great way to do it. I mean, you've got the so the scene, the sort of cold open before that, if you like, is the scene, that doesn't involve the Beatles, and then when they're shown, as you say, initially in black and white, you know, it occurred to me while watching it for the, you know, 20th time or however many times I've seen this, for the first time it occurred to me, this would have been the first time millions of people had ever seen the Beatles in colour at all, because all they'd seen of them, you know, there was A Hard Day's Night, there was news footage, there was pictures in newspapers, maybe even magazines, mainly black and white. Lots and lots of people never seen them in colour before. And what a great way to introduce it, by starting off with them in black and white and then, as you say, like having these flashes of colour going through that scene, just sort of bringing them to life in full... in full glorious technicolour, you know?
Yes, exactly. And I guess made more vivid because each dart then corresponds to a credit that appears on screen, doesn't it? So in the same colour as that dart that's been thrown, I think, apart from on one occasion.
Mm.
But yeah, just like, I think already straight off the bat, you've got this sort of quite inventive technique, or, you know, it's sort of quite a creative idea that's sort of that's setting out its stall, I guess, in terms of, like, you know, what we might come to see next, which I think is, you know, it works really well.
Yeah, and I think also, like, it's not just a sort of straight band performance either. I mean, so this is where it kind of starts to align with the music video as we come to know it, because it is playing around with focus, so it will sort of maybe focus on a character in the foreground and have the blur in the background, or then kind of vice versa. So there's a bit where in the sort of break in Help where it's, it doesn't have a middle eight, does it? But then there's a bit after maybe the second chorus when it's John repeats when I was younger, so much younger than today, mm-hmm. but it's just single chord strums before they go on. And so when that's happening, what you're seeing is in the background, John singing it, but he's out of focus. And in the foreground, you see George playing those chords,
mm.
and it really focuses on his fretting fingers.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that, you know, and that just makes you think, oh, they're doing something a bit different here. Like, and maybe pop stars haven't been accorded this level of sort of artistic, I don't know, reverence is the word, but, you know, maybe nobody's really bothered to shoot pop stars like this before.
And do you think that's because, you know, because I was really, I'm always quite pleased to see a lot of time spent on actually showing the musicality of the song mm. and the instrumentation.
Yeah.
So you're right, there's loads of, and throughout this film, in the songs, there's loads of focus on the actual fretboard, fretting fingers, mm. to the extent you can probably learn how to play all of these songs just from watching this film.
Yeah.
But do you think that's because there was a point to be made here about the, you know, we hear often in the Beatles story about how they were a band that decided to write their own songs, and that was unusual at the time they decided to do that, and now yeah. we're in sort of like peak Beatlemania period. There's a point to be made about emphasizing and capitalizing on that. You know, these are guys that can play their own instruments, and these are songs they have written, and to prove it, here they are playing them.
Yeah, yeah, maybe. You know, I'm sure it wasn't. I don't know how conscious any of these things are. I was watching the other night one of the My Life as a Rolling Stone documentaries that's on the BBC iPlayer. I don't know if you've seen any mm-hmm. of those. But the Jagger one, which is the first episode. So he was saying quite early on that Andrew Lew Golden basically said, like, well, the Beatles are writing their own songs. You guys need to start writing your own songs. We can't just be doing these sort of old blues covers forever. Mm. So just go off and write some songs, you know.
Right.
And so Jagger and Richards just kind of did, you know. And I'm sure it took them a little while, but I think by 1965 that idea was more widespread.
Right.
There are bands or artists who write their own songs. But you're right. It was kind of. When the Beatles came along, there was certainly Buddy Holly, and of course the Beach Boys, who started around the same time, just, you know, the other side of the world, who were, you know, and Brian Wilson was already writing songs by then. The
early days, absolutely, right? Yeah. Since when he was 16.
Yeah, so I think it was kind of more widespread as an idea, but I don't think this had. The point you make about this kind of emphasizing that in film, I'm not sure had particularly been made for the first, you know, it particularly been made before.
Yeah, for that purpose. Shall we move on to the next song?
Yeah.
So You're Gonna Lose That Girl, which is them recording in a studio. The sort of the context for how this appears in the film is that there have been a series of attempts to take the ring from Ringo.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just the Beatles carrying on their normal Beatles day, by being in a studio recording a song.
Yeah.
And then after the song finishes, there is the latest attempt to take that ring by sort of soaring underneath Ringo's drum set and having him fall through the floor so they can trap him. So you've got this idea either side of the song about you know, this an attempt, but it's another attempt being made to take the ring. And what they do, slap bang in the middle of that, it just had this really massively cool, like, segment where they just have, you know, these amazing colours and backlighting and, like, awesome smoke like, hues coming through, you know, each frame. And it just looks really, it looks very modern.
Yeah, it really does.
Yeah.
And I think the restored Blu-ray that we both have looks fantastic, really fantastic, and I think there is nowhere else it shows up better than in this sequence. I think the effort that has gone in, as I was saying, you know, similarly to Help, the effort that has gone into actual cinematography and thinking about shots, and the way they're lined up. And as you say, there's this sort of blue hue in kind of certain shots that they take. There's Ringo drums the entire thing with a cigarette in his mouth, which as a teenager I thought incredibly cool, and still do a bit now if I'm honest. And his cigarette smoke kind of catches that light, and it really sort of colours the whole thing. And I think also this is as well as it this being a scene. It makes narrative sense. The band The Beatles are in the in this film are recording a song for an album to be released by The Beatles, but also it is taking, I'm not saying certain liberties, but they're playing drum, bass, two guitars, but then as it goes on you also see Ringo playing the congas
and, oh yes, you do, that's right,
and,
yeah,
and Paul at the piano as well.
Yes,
so it's like that they are, what you're seeing is also them. This is more than one take you're seeing of the same song.
Yes, they're there's a license to be had with like exploring all of the actual what goes into a recording session.
Yeah, or it is not necessarily literally that we are seeing more than one take of this song. It's that we are going into the territory of the music video, as opposed to a scene, a narrative scene in a film.
Yeah, that makes sense.
We're being shown different elements of how this might come together, and. Because I can remember watching it when I was younger and thinking, well, hang on, how's Ringo playing the congas here?
Oh, really?
He was on the drums a minute ago. How has Paul just gone over? I mean, who's playing the bass? Now he's gone to the piano.
How is this not live?
Right, yeah. Exactly. But I think probably just because I couldn't quite think through what was meant by that, that this is not just one take of it, But yeah, license, as you say, is a good way to put it. They are kind of taking license with the thing. And it's a creative choice, as opposed to this is a scene in which. So you think back in Hard Day's Night, an equivalent scene is when they're in the rehearsal space and they play If I Fell, for example. Same thing. This is the band, The Beatles, playing the characters of The Beatles, recording a song as the band, The Beatles, would. But it's just them playing it. That's what you see.
And I think that's. This is the point where you start to realize that these song segments have an interesting way of being presented.
Yeah.
Not just because of the incredible, way that the scenes have been set, the lighting and how it's all captured on film, but just, like you said before, about how the Beatles themselves are framed and how, the camera is moving between them in focus and out of focus. It feels like there's an approach here that's deliberately creative in order to set itself apart from just a band playing their songs.
Yeah.
And I have to go back to the remastered point that you made as well. This, I think, is probably one of the best bits in the whole film that looks, as good as it does.
Yeah.
I think there's quite a brilliant special feature on the Blu-ray that talks to the team that were behind the remastering. And just really interesting hearing them talk about how, for example, they had to approach something like Help at the start of the film and how they had to make creative decisions around what scuffs and marks are on the film and what scuffs and marks are actually in the film that they should retain. that's an incredibly difficult job.
Right.
It must be hard for, Help, where you've got the look of an actual projector screen, which has its own sort of dents and scratches in it, and the film being played on that they have to retain. But with this, it just feels like all of that is removed. They've got a very clear, sultry look and feel to this whole segment that you don't have to worry so much about trying to capture a sort of a worn element that already exists in the film. This is just about making it look awesome.
Yeah.
And they do a fantastic job. It just looks really cool.
Yeah.
Can't sort of geek out about it enough, really.
Yeah. I think also the thing we were saying earlier when we were talking about Help is the sort of focus on the musicianship. It's like one very specific bit at the start of You're Gonna Lose That Girl is where you start off, you're looking at a camera that's just behind Ringo. And so like as he puts this cigarette in his mouth, which he'll then keep there for 3 minutes or whatever it is, He is just kind of like sitting there, like quite casually smoking, doing this. And then someone goes, one, two, three. And then they sing the first verse and then the drums come in after the first four bars or whatever that is. And the way he goes in with his fill, the straight, and it's just it looks incredibly cool. It's very well shot, and it does highlight that. I mean, as if you needed telling, like, this guy is a really good drummer.
Okay, so let's get on to You've Got to Hide Your Love Away, which, you know, like I said earlier, this is something that I feel like it exists outside of the film.
Yeah.
In a way, for example, that the previous two songs don't. They have their own sort of identity.
Yeah.
But this feels like the video footage that comes from this film feels like it accompanies the song in a way that it feels like it extends or enhances the song in some way, because it feels like it's so attached to this particular performance.
Yeah.
But in the context of the film, I am left wondering, why? Why are you playing this song now? Like, it's the first time that there's no narrative reason for him to be playing the song, so therefore you would expect the song's subject matter to be relevant to what's happening narratively at that time. But it's not.
Yeah.
They're just playing a song.
I mean, they are hiding, I suppose. You know.
I don't know. That wasn't my main take from the song.
Okay. No. Fair enough. You're absolutely right. It doesn't fit. I think that. So I mean, we're kind of regular listeners may remember our episode on Across the Universe, which is the Beatles jukebox musical. So that is in which characters, like any musical, will burst into song to express emotion or to demonstrate to the viewer that this is a conversation being had, but you, the viewer, are seeing it in song. It's a stylized element. So Help is not a musical, nor is A Hard Day's Night. It is a film in which the characters are a band who perform songs, but they do that with varying degrees of narrative justification for them. So this is the one where there's no reason for them to sing this song.
It feels very much like the purpose of having it there is because a certain amount of time has gone by and they need a song. Like that's basically it.
But actually, it's funny, like, how the way it's inserted in the film feels very throwaway for a song that is, as far as I'm concerned, like, lyrically and musically, one of John Lennon's very best songs.
Yes.
I mean, it really is. It's a really special song. He's rarely written lyrics. I mean, certainly in this period of his career, he was rarely writing lyrics as good as this, that takes a really cohesive narrative, or takes the narrator of the song is a character, I suppose, and everything the singer sings is consistent with that character.
Yeah, you know, I see what you mean.
It's really, really well put together. And yeah, the way it's thrown into the film is almost, I'm not going to say an afterthought, because it's well shot. There are funny things happening, you know, with sort of George and Paul competing for Ame's affections just through their facial expressions. The guy who is like George's gardener in his George's bedroom has grass instead of a carpet. And there's a gardener who he employs, and then the gardener just plays the flute solo at the end.
Yes, which is brilliant.
Which is great, you know. And so, I mean, it goes without saying, it more than earns its place. But in terms of what it's doing for the story, no, it's not doing. It's not doing anything.
And I think this, you know, it is indicative of what we will no doubt end up discussing in the next part of this episode. In that there's a lot of inconsistency in this film. There's a lot of incoherence in this film.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of stuff that it feels like it has been thrown together. And really the only sort of, I guess, central idea that everything hangs off is just the idea of the Beatles. But other than that, it's very much, you know, a bit of a free-for-all.
Yeah.
So it's not surprising that this song features in the film in this way. But it is probably the first instance of, musically, of a bit of a head-scratcher.
Yeah, but then again, I mean, none of the other songs, I mean, arguably the title song kind of has a theme of like they're in trouble, so they need help. But other than that, because it isn't a musical, none of them are singing songs at the time to express the emotions that they are going through as characters in this film. they are singing songs because they are a band and that's their job and they need to record songs.
Yes.
Other than this.
Yes. And that's the thing. There are some songs that have a narrative justification for being in the film.
Mm.
And then there are other songs that are there because it's just them playing a song.
Yeah.
For all of the hijinks that there are to enjoy in this film,
yeah.
I think my favourite Beatle moments are when they're doing something deadpan.
Yeah.
And there is... I will point out in both of these parts of this episode, I will point out all of the deadpan moments that I particularly enjoyed.
Yeah.
And it's not supposed to be funny at all, but there's something I really, really enjoy about Ringo's single tambourine hit that he balls out of nowhere. Like, you've got Lennon playing and singing along the song, but he just out of nowhere just does a single hit. Perfect. Obviously, you know it's coming because you know the song.
Yeah.
But he's not looking, he doesn't look like he's partaking in the song in any way, but he just does it like it's sort of...
Yeah.
Something he can't help but do.
Yeah, great. Well, he's sitting there looking quite sort of mournful, isn't he?
He is, exactly.
And I forget who it was who just sort of pointed out that Ringo's resting face is always like quite mournful. Like he just looks like it looks a bit miserable just when his face is doing nothing else. Yeah. And so, yeah, he's just staring straight ahead. And just picking up the tambourine and just hitting it, you know, on every beat. And yeah, you're right, it's lovely.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
So, talking of hijinks, we then move on to Ticket to Ride, which is the key number, I think, in this film.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, it doesn't, I feel like it's ended up being the key number in this film. Like I said earlier, it's not, I don't think it was sort of written that way, but it seems to be that way. I put it to you that there is no better illustration of the Beatles being the Beatles at this time than this montage of them skiing and falling over and just generally having a really good laugh.
Yeah.
Clearly just messing about for a full 3 minutes, whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's just really, really fun to watch.
Yeah, yeah. And Richard Lester explains in an interview on the Blu-ray that he said to them, do any of you know how to ski? We should rewind a bit back to that bit in the anthology, which I think is one of the Paul driving a tugboat interview scenes.
Right, okay.
Where he's talking about the fact that, you know, it's like, oh, we'd like to go to the Bahamas. Can you write that in? And then he says, oh, I've never been skiing. Could you write that in?
Yeah.
Which, you know, if he's to be believed, that's kind of how that came about. And Richard Lester seems to back it up. And then apparently what happens for this scene is Richard Lester says, does any of you know how to ski? And they all say no. And he said, right, don't learn.
Right.
I want to film you learning to ski.
Yeah.
And that's apparently exactly what we see there for sort of...
There was also the hint, I believe, of him just doing it before anyone got involved and asked the question about insurance.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Which totally makes sense.
Can you imagine now trying to make a film with our old friends BTS... and trying to get them to do, I don't know, parkour or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, when none of them have done it before.
To do parkour.
Yeah. Like on an incredibly high buildings, and the amount of like insurance you'd have to go through for that, and health and safety, and all that kind of stuff. Like quite rightly as well. Like,
arguably, not the same risk involved in asking BTS to jump off a high building than there is in getting the Beatles to strap some skis to their feet. But
no,
yeah, there's a danger all the same. I appreciate that. Also, interestingly, I don't know how much that is to be believed. What Paul said about having it written in because they also go skiing, because there's also this point about one of the reasons they decided to shoot in Austria is because it was one of the easier ways for them to get away from sort of Beatlemania crowds.
Yeah.
So it felt like there was a bit of a decision there to sort of go to Austria. I mean, I guess they could have decided that after the skiing suggestion.
Yeah,
who knows? But yeah, it's just really, really fun. I think we're both talking before we started recording that I think a highlight of this whole montage is them using the telegraph wires as a blank stave on which to like notate the melody of the vocals.
Yep.
I think it's just a really clever thing to do. Apparently Richard Lester liked the shot, but thought that the telegraph wires were ugly. And then the sort of solution came about that they would put the notes on them. I just think it's a really nice inventive thing to do in that sequence.
Yeah, yeah. And I'd actually, like I say, I've seen this film God knows how many times. It was the first time I noticed that those were actual electrical wires that they were doing that on. All I'd ever seen before was just a superimposed stave on the screen. You know,
there's
the nice thing about rewatching these things. You always notice something new.
Particularly in this film as well, because I think in this film, if things move so fast and the dialogue is so haphazard that, you know, I don't think I've watched this as many times as you have, but I've watched particular scenes in this many, many times. And I feel like I'm still only understanding half of all the gags that are there or all the exchanges that are there.
Yeah.
And I think that goes for these kind of sequences as well. Like one of the reasons why that Ticket to Ride montage is so watchable is because there's just so much in there.
Yeah.
That's just fun to watch. And, you know, we were talking before we started recording there, but just the way that the film plays with perspective quite often during these sequences.
Yeah.
In this one in particular, having the Beatles hold their ski pole up to the camera and twist and turn it and change expression as the pole moves. Just really fun. Just like, you know, you know the way that looks on camera, you know that's going to produce an interesting thing. And I just feel like that was the brief for this montage, wasn't it? Like, let's just find interesting things to do and film all of them.
Yeah.
And we'll cut it together into a sequence.
Yeah, it must have been. And I think also, like, there's bits where so a lot of it is them clowning around and falling over on skis and things like that. There's other bits where they are all just sort of out of focus and all just staring at the camera, standing there, like a sort of album cover photo shoot, you know, like not smiling, you know, just looking at the camera like quite seriously, quite earnestly. And that's a shot that's kind of in there, you know, and you think, oh, it's quite considered this.
Yeah.
You know, there's a, I'm not going to talk about image necessarily, but there's a sort of, they and Richard Lester are all thinking about how the Beatles look and how they're presented to the public, in a sense. There's the clowning and there's also the seriousness, you know. If you think about it, it's actually, you know, on a very general level, it's remarkable that these guys, it took them a while to be sort of properly lauded critically as great songwriters. Like, some people kind of got there earlier than others did, critically, I mean. But isn't it kind of nuts that they were doing that and there were people who were recognising them as not necessarily the key cultural contributors to the 20th century that we sort of went on to be, but people were recognising them as great songwriters while they were in films where they were just mucking about. do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's not just because there's a difference. I mean, we've talked about their humour before and, you know, when they sort of got to JFK and did that press conference and everyone found them really funny and it was, oh God, these guys are a breath of fresh air. But it's also, you think about the album, Help has, it's not in the film, but it has Yesterday on it.
Yeah.
Which, you know, what very few people would claim that is not one of the most significant musical compositions of the 20th century. And it's on an album where like its composer is on there walking into a men's bathroom where the hand dryer has gone nuts and pulls the sleeve off his jacket and then he gets hit in the face by a jet of water. But it's ridiculous how those two things coexist.
Yeah,
you know, and how I'm not sure there's anyone else any other artists in history who are able to do those two things simultaneously.
I mean, it helps that he's not playing Yesterday whilst that happens in the film. I think that would undermine the sentiment of the song somewhat.
Right, yeah.
But I think, to me, that sort of just, again, points to what we know about how incredibly fast-paced and how packed the Beatles' timeline is.
Yeah.
You know, like, these things do coexist, but they only coexist when you're looking at them as happening in the same month. And actually, you know, like, what happens to the Beatles in a month is enough to fill, you know, most pop bands' lifetimes.
Yeah,
you know? Deadpan action number two, for me, my favourite thing in the Ticket to Ride sequence is when they're playing and larking about on the piano in the song, and John is lying on top of the piano playing it while singing.
Yeah,
but McCartney is sat down on the floor in front of it, all wrapped up nice and warm, and every now and again he'll just randomly like pull out a chord.
Oh, does he?
Every now and again, like he doesn't even turn around, but he's just like, he's sat facing forward. He's like wrapped up in the warm because he's freezing cold. Yeah. Is the impression you get. But every now and again in time, he'll just like throw his hand behind himself and just throw a chord out on the piano and then put it back again.
Right.
Very, very funny. So then we move on to the next song segment, or should I say segments, which are "I Need You" and "The Night Before."
Yep.
So the context for this is, having understood now that their lives are in danger, they have requested the help of Scotland Yard to keep them safe and give them some security whilst they go back into the studio and record these songs.
Yep.
What that leads to is, this security is quite a neat, I think, visual gag around how they are basically recording, in quotation marks, out in the open.
Yeah.
And you have this sort of one wall of a studio between an engineer and them playing,
which has
the window in, which I love, because, you know, like, the window exists so that he can see them. Like, so they've got the one wall, this idea that he wouldn't be able to see them otherwise whilst recording them, which is hilarious.
Yeah.
And then obviously they are surrounded by lots of sort of military soldiers, tanks, etc. for the sort of chaotic action scene that follows these segments. I was struck, I mean, first of all, I was struck mostly by, just of all the songs that go in the film, this is the George one, like seeing him sing for the first time. You know, I think it's, I'm never really too sure how much stock to put in this idea that there was an agreement in the band that George should have one of his numbers on there. You know, like, how much did they agree to have a Lennon McCartney production but also throw George a bone, like, per album or something? If there is stock to be found in that, and it feels like, then that's why this number is one of the songs highlighted in the film as well.
I guess so. I suppose that I'm not sure whether they were making any more money from, like, releasing the album, but then also extra money for having the song in the film.
That's true.
I'm not sure how that works. Hard Day's Night is the only album that is 100% Lennon McCartney songs. So George didn't have a song. He sung on that, didn't he? He sung "I'm Happy Just to Dance with You," but he hadn't written a song on a film before. So yeah, I wonder whether that was a thing. But I mean, also, he was a better songwriter by that point.
Yes,
like,
true.
Yeah. I Need You is certainly not one of his classics, but it's a lovely song. It's one of his sort of simpler ones, really. Like, there's not a lot of, it's all sort of major chords. It's all quite bright and acoustic-y and strummy, you know, and the arrangement's really nice.
You just have this, like, you have this interesting sound at this song, don't you? Like, the way it starts off, this sort of ringing tone to the guitar that plays out the chords. I always found quite interesting. Just that interesting sort of guitar tone that the song has at start, and hearing that kick in before George starts singing. Yeah, it's just, I, you know, there's nothing really to add other than the fact that it's just an interesting thing that the song does.
Itself, absolutely. You know? Yeah, but I think it's a really nice song. And I think, I mean, so the way that, as you say, the way these are put in narratively is they've had to go to a recording studio, which happens to be outdoors because they need military protection. So there's a reason for these songs to be there, this and The Night Before. They are sort of interrupted more than the other songs are. So if you think about, you've got To Hide Your Love Away, it's just played all the way through.
Mm.
I think that applies to the others in general as well.
Yeah.
This is sort of interrupted by other scenes. where the people, the cults trying to catch them are sort of putting their preparations in place for their latest sort of dastardly plan to blow them up. So you're cutting away from the songs. And I forget whether it's both songs being cut away from.
Yeah, or... I think it's both songs being cut away from, because you have Arme trying to deceive Klang and suggest that they've buried a tunnel directly underneath to where the Beatles are playing so that they can plant explosives.
Yeah.
So you have like this sort of exchange of dialogue whilst the songs are playing.
Yeah.
But I actually found it really interesting that in order to try to convince Klang that they are where they should be and lying to him in the process, she plays him a tape recorder playing a different song.
She's a woman.
Is it She's a Woman? Yeah. Right, okay, fine, of course. So what you end up having is that part of it plays during the night before. So you have the actual song segment of a night before, and then it would cut between that to this scene underground where She's a Woman is playing. And it's like, it's one thing to cut to dialogue, but to cut to a different song playing in the middle of a song that's playing is actually quite jarring.
And
I get the, you know, I get the idea that they're trying to sell, Richard Lester is trying to sell the idea that it's a lie.
Yeah.
But actually, I do feel like that takes away from the actual performance of the song in the film.
Yes. Somewhat. Yeah, it does a bit. And I think, because you're right. I suppose if, like, while they're playing the night before, if she then puts a tape recorder of the night before into that little thing in the tunnel, then perhaps we as an audience don't quite get what she's doing.
Yes.
The fact that it's a different song makes it very clear to us.
Yes. Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, because it could be that she's playing the live performance as we are hearing it,
right? Yeah.
But yeah, it's a weird thing. I can't think of many films that would have that same thing of showcasing a song but actually frequently cutting away to a scene where you've got like a different song playing. Feels like it undermines the thing a little bit. So then we get to the last performed song segment of the film, which is Another Girl in the Bahamas. For reasons, I think, I guess they go in disguise and go on the run, right? So they that's the idea from the cult. But, you know, behind the scenes, we know that this is one of those things where the group are just like, can we shoot in the Bahamas? And Brian Epstein apparently phoned up Richard Lester and said, make it happen, because the Beatles have asked for it, so he did. Despite the fact that when they got there, apparently it wasn't actually that warm. It was quite chilly.
Yeah,
I think it's quite evident as well when you see them playing that where they are, they don't look like they're in sort of the sunniest of climes.
But they
performed the song Another Girl. Again, some interesting directorial choices made there in terms of how the band are framed and how the group are set out. They've got pretty ladies with them for much of the performance of the song.
Yep.
And there are some sort of sequences during the song that occur that are interesting, but none more interesting. McCartney's accidental strumming of a lady.
But it seems quite deliberate. It's very, very conscious non-strumming of a lady.
Yes.
Isn't it? You know?
Yes.
So we should probably explain what we mean.
Well, we should, You go ahead.
So there is a sequence. So the performance of Another Girl... they're sort of swapping instruments quite a lot, which again, you know, is kind of saying, this is another one where they are kind of performing the song to camera. It's a music video, but they're not, the characters aren't kind of recording the song or anything like that, as far as we know. But in all this instrument swapping, at one point, one of these women who in swimming costumes who are hanging around, Paul is kind of playing her as if she is a bass, or no, as if she's a guitar. So he is sort of fretting.
She has
he's fretting her arm.
Let's try to cover this off together so that we cover all bases. She is standing there with her arm extended to double up as the neck of a guitar.
Yes.
So he is fretting her arm.
Yes.
Whilst strumming to the other side of her torso.
Yes.
However, there is very clearly an instance where his strumming goes too close to her torso.
Oh, I see. I thought because I didn't notice that. I thought what we were talking about is him, because you can see there is a very, very
studious expression on his face where he's really trying hard not to do that.
Yes.
But it actually happens, does it?
Oh wow, you've missed the delights if you haven't noticed this, because right. Not only does it happen, but yeah. The expression on his face when it does, like the sheer look of embarrassment and horror,
right.
Like the immediate, and it literally lasts like half a second, but right. it's so funny, because he just catches himself. Very, very funny. Right. I would urge you to go back and watch that as soon as you can, because it's the best look I've ever seen Macca give. and that's the biggest talking point of Another Girl for me, is Macca's expression in that, because it makes the film.
I think there are some lovely things in that Another Girl, you know, video, if you want to call it that, because it essentially is one, where the way they're being framed. So again, it's one of those things where Richard Lester is kind of playing with focus quite a lot, and so there are scenes where again they're looking completely straight faced. Straight in down the barrel of the camera, but they're all kind of standing in a line, and it might kind of focus in on one of their faces and then focus out and it's one of the girls' faces. Various bits in it as well where they're all kind of standing on different bits of what looks like a sort of ruin or something like that. And again, it's just one of those things you don't bother to do because this is the thing about this. I mean, Richard Lester could be completely excused for just shooting these songs as straight up performances.
Yeah.
He's obviously got more ambition about
that. That's what all people are there to see, right?
Yeah.
As well. There are no other expectations then.
Right, exactly. You know, because if you think about, you know, the Elvis films that they would have gone to see themselves, like John talks about it at one point, you know, we used to go and see Elvis in these movies and everyone would scream and we'd think that's a good job. The movies they would have seen, sort of Blue Hawaii or whatever, where, you know, he's just he's some guy, and then he just sings a song to a girl at some point.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah.
And nobody's really thinking about it beyond that. Are they even musicals? I'm not sure how to categorize them, really. But yeah, everyone here could have been forgiven for just bothering a lot less with these sequences.
Yeah,
I think it's fantastic that, you know, this amount of effort went in, and these sequences are such a success for that.
Exactly that, but I think it points to a clear decision to approach them in this way, right? So early on, I think Richard Lester would have said, you know, these need to be sort of marked out in some way. These can't just be a performance; they need to be like a creative endeavor of some kind for each song. Which I think, absolutely, is testament to him and to the output. So those are all the song segments in the film. Shortly after Another Girl, we have the resolution of the movie. Ringo, after all of his sort of trials and tribulations throughout the whole film, finds the ring just falls off his finger.
It's handy, that, wasn't it?
Is it very handy? Yeah. And then there persists a sort of chaotic sequence to end the movie on, as films of this age tend to do, and this sort of genre tend to do, where there's just lots of people on a beach sort of fighting each other, and lots of sort of, you know, craziness ensues, to a repeat soundtrack of Help.
Yep.
Which neatly puts everything into a nice loop, but arguably makes less sense because there's no need for any help at that point, because they've already resolved the actual central plot line of their lives no longer being in danger.
But it is kicked off by Klang now needing help and saying help, which is then mouthed over the, you know,
That is I mean, there's still a lot to unpick there, isn't there, in terms of like does Klang have the authority to kick off a Beatles song, like
well, yeah. Yeah, exactly. I wonder if anyone else has in cinema history.
We should mention, obviously, throughout the film there are interesting things to talk about in the score as well. So I think most pointedly to me, the things that I picked up on whilst watching the film from a score point of view, there's a point during an early car chase where a very deliberate use of the James Bond theme is used.
Yeah.
First of all, I mean, we'll get onto this in the next part, but this film is talked about as a satire on Bond films, and I'm not sure I completely buy that, but the fact that it uses a Bond theme or Bond theme like piece of music is probably what really closely ties this film to that franchise.
Yeah.
But more interestingly is the use of other Beatles songs in the score.
Yeah. Yeah.
Most noticeably, Hard Day's Night, which right. happens quite a lot throughout this.
Yeah, exactly, which is kind of one of the main sort of dramatic sequence, that sort of motif that keeps on coming back. It was interesting you used the title song from your last film yeah. as the sort of probably the main bit of the score.
I think it's used three times in various forms in the movie. There is, towards the end of the film, it's used twice. One as has an action quality to it.
Yeah.
There's like an epic style version that plays right towards the end. But actually, probably the most notable version is when they're in the Indian restaurant and the cult take over the band on stage and take over their instruments, and they start playing a song then, and it happens to be a version of Hard Day's Night that features heavily a sitar.
Yeah.
Which is very notable because that's where George got his love of the sitar from.
Yep.
And also notable because if you're ever in a Beatles quiz or a pop quiz and someone asks you what is the first time a sitar was used on a pop record and someone answers that with Norwegian Wood, they are incorrect because this sitar version of Hard Day's Night actually was released on the American version of the Help soundtrack. So that's the first time the sitar would have been used in a sort of pop setting.
Yeah.
And arguably helped prime fans to that sound before it was then used in Norwegian Wood.
Yes, you're right. I like the way you framed that as just a way to win an argument with an imaginary person. As if, actually, not so. Imaginary friends.
I have too few instances in my life where someone picks an argument with me that I can win. So sometimes I find it better if I just assume the scenario first.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good way to spend your time. Yes, you're right. And I think there's nice the way that some bits are dropped in. She's a Woman is one that's dropped in. There's a little motive like that every now and again. You Can't Do That is in there as well. The sort of I've Got Something to Say That Might Cause You Pain bit. And there's a bit of I'm Happy Just to Dance with You as well. I can't quite call that to mind, but I remember writing that down. It's nice because none of these are, other than, like, Hard Day's Night is, you know, is a sort of, is a Red Album song, if you like, you know, one that everyone knows. The other ones are less obvious B-sides, album tracks, that kind of thing. And it's nice that they find this kind of second life as, you know, that they're not trying to get the big hits and shoehorn them into the score. You know, they're generally just using ones that work. And it's a really good score.
It is a great score. Yeah. George Martin has a lot to blame that. Although there is this notion that George Martin has brought in to write some of the arrangements for some of the songs, but actually he wasn't picked as the overall composer for the film.
Mm.
Or he refers to that later on as him being included out of the film, which is quite neat. But there is also, you know, just to add to your list of Beatles songs there, From Me to You, which is has a brilliant version of that that's also available on that second half of the American version of the Help soundtrack.
Yeah.
It's really interesting to that song. And I think we've covered all of the musical elements of the film, apart from the last one, which is the band themselves singing and humming along to The Barber of Seville as the end credits play, which is most notable for when they stop doing that. Because my favourite bit in all of that is they're committed to humming and singing the melody of this. I think when the phrasing comes around again for a second time, they whistle it. But it's very much clearly improvised at the time. And then there's one particular instance when you realise that as they're doing this, they're watching the credits come up on screen because you hear George Harrison call out, "I Need You" by George Harrison, which is, from what I understand about George, quite typical of George.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. It's it's Goon Show, isn't it? I mean, that is total classic Goon Show that they listened to on the radio when they were kids. Here's a thing and let's muck about next to it and see what happens.
It's just, it's like one like final act of irreverence in the film that it's just like, if there is a rule to be had about a movie, like, let's find a way to break it. And like, it's just that to me is that, like, the, you know, no credit sequence up until that point and probably since has been performed in that quite the same way.
Yeah.
Because it's just like, let's just absolutely mess about right up until the very last minute.
Yeah. And why not? Yeah. And actually the approach of essentially sort of defacing a classic
Yes.
Reminds me of, I can't remember which Monty Python album it was, but the album cover is an existing classical, like a Beethoven or something like that, but it is scribbled out with Monty Python written on the top.
Right, yeah. It's the same, of course. Yes, I don't know what you mean. Yes.
It's the same approach, isn't it, I suppose?
Yes,
it's
taking
something, it's in quite a gentle and cheeky way. Irreverent is the right word. It's just taking something that is quite old and stuffy and just putting your mark on it, destroying it, but, you know, to your own audience, improving it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you're right. Yes, that's a good point. And also, it's not without precedent as well. This is happening at the end of a film that has also contained a fairly lengthy Ode to Joy sequence that we haven't mentioned.
Yeah.
The 1812 Overture plays during the sort of chaotic military action sequence.
Yeah.
There are sort of snippets of sort of classical music woven throughout it. And I, you know, like you say, I guess it helps provide that juxtaposition between sort of that sort of old school, older generation music to be enjoyed versus sort of the new big thing. That's Gear Fab.
Yeah.
Is there anything else to add on the music elements of the film Help?
No, I don't think so.
I don't think so either. So that's a wrap then for part one of our discussion of Help. Hopefully you've enjoyed us discussing the music part of the music film Help. And before we go on to part two, which will discuss the film part of the music film Help.
It's very neat.
there's logic here. Hopefully you enjoyed that. If you did, please let us know. You can find us on the usual social media platforms at Beatles Films Pod. And otherwise, we will see you next week for part two of our discussion of Help. See you then. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.